My hope is that if we understand which microbes or how the microbes are involved, we might be able to manipulate the microbiome by putting a community of microbes on the surface of the leaf, or by breeding for resistance to the microbes, not the aphid, because we have very few sources of resistance that are functional against the aphid itself. But it's possible that since the microbes are essential for aphid virulence or aggressiveness, we might be able to breed for resistance to the microbes, and that would make our wheat more resistant.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wyzenetics. I am Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. With us today is Dr. Jan Leach. She is University Distinguished Professor, Department of Agriculture Biology at Colorado State University. Dr. Leach is a plant pathologist who studies the molecular basis of plant disease susceptibility and the resistance of how these responses are influenced by interactions within the phytobiome. Dr. Leach is the intermediate past president of the International Society of Plant Pathology and is a fellow and past president of the American Phytopathological Society, APS. She's also a fellow American Association for the Advancement of Sciences and fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology. Dr. Leach was elected to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences in 2021. Dr. Leach, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and joining us on the Crop Science Podcast Show.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So if you don't mind, give a little bit about your pathway to the position. And I got to say, there's not too many times I get to announce and introduce a scientist that has so many fellows. And that is an outstanding accomplishment. And I know what it means to be within the societies to achieve that. So, wow. I'll just say that. Wow.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So where did I start? Yeah, I started as a kid from Nebraska. And I worked as an undergraduate. I was in microbiology, but I was interested in applying my microbiology and not necessarily interested in going into any of the medical fields. So I worked in plant pathology at UNL, Nebraska, and I studied diseases of sclerotinia on bean, and also bacteria on corn, and worked with Ann Vitiver and Jim Stedman there. At the same time I was doing my master's in microbiology. So then when I was ready to do a PhD, they encouraged me to go into plant pathology, which I thought was a great idea. So I went to Wisconsin and studied under Luis Sequeira, and I studied interactions of bacteria and tobacco, trying to understand how bacteria induce symptoms or disease in tobacco, and how could we use that information to help protect the plants. Then I was hired at the internet. England. I was hired by Guinness Beer and the Hops Marketing Board to study Verticillium albolatrum in hops or hop wilt. So that was my one foray into fungi. And I was there for almost three and a half years, which was a great experience because I worked with hop growers. I learned a lot about how hops are used to make beer. And it was just a wonderful experience for a kid from Nebraska who had never been outside the United States. And then after that, I got a job at Kansas State where I was for 20 years. And I then my husband and I were enticed to move to Colorado State University. My husband is Ned Tisserat. He was an extension person here at Kansas State and then here at Colorado State. So we were moved to Colorado. So we started a new painting here. And that's sort of my path. I was lucky. I mean, if you think about it, a woman in my era and her husband getting jobs twice on our own merits It was quite an interesting path.
I guess two parts, because out of Oklahoma State, Kansas State, well, Colorado is still quite near. We're all within that plains and everything operates. So Before we go into your current work, what was some of those 20 years at KSU? What was some of the work you're involved with at Kansas?
Well, interestingly, when I started at Kansas State, I was hired as in those days it was called a disease physiologist. Mm-hmm. And so I was, they knew I might work in model systems or other things. So I wanted to work in an important disease, in an important crop, and where I could probably make some inroads into understanding the questions I was asking. So I talked to different people, and I realized that rice was a diploid, so an easy genome. Wheat's got a, you know, a pretty hexaploid genome. My brain doesn't handle hexaploids very well. And the most important disease of rice is a bacterial disease of rice is Xanthomonas oryzae, or bacterial blight of rice. And so I'm in a wheat state and I'm working on rice. And initially the dean wasn't very happy about it until I started to bring in funding. And then I tried to say, well, you know, they're both monocots. Rice is a good model for wheat. I knew that someday the rice genome would be sequenced. I knew that the bacteria I could manage, and those there were bacterial diseases of wheat. So I think it was the right move, but it was a dangerous move.
And like you said, at least in academia, a lot of the times you can convince deans if you're able to bring in the proper external funding.
Yeah, that helped.
Now, you know, you've transitioned out, you're working in the rice and rice blight and at Kansas. What are you doing at Colorado, and where did you start and what are you doing now?
So I moved my entire program here. And so I still work with rice, understanding disease resistance mechanisms in rice. And that's kind of my passion. But when I moved here, bacterial blight became listed as a select agent. And so that makes research a lot more difficult. It's a lot more expensive. You know, it's an unfunded mandate. So we have to figure out how to get all those things in place. But I still work on that and I'm still passionate about it. And I still collaborate with the International Rice Research Institute and also with CIAT in Colombia. And in fact, I always say to people that I owe my career to the International Rice Research Institute and to the Rockefeller Foundation, who funded me for many years in rice. So I also wanted to pick up some interesting projects here. And I started to work with Russian wheat aphid interactions with their microbiome on wheat. And that's been a really exciting project because it allows me to look at a system, a bigger system, where the microbiome of the Russian wheat aphid is essential for it to cause symptoms on wheat. And that's sort of exciting. In fact, the student that led that project just defended her PhD on Friday. So I'm very proud of her.
Well, I'm going to get there, but I want to go back to rice because there's a lot of interesting questions that are in my first. Have you were able to go to the Philippines being sponsored by Erie? So many trips.
Yeah, many trips. I used to go for at least once a year for years. And I would spend, you know, anywhere from a week to 3 weeks at Erie. I actually taught a rice research to production course there with my colleagues from Erie. And we would bring students from the U.S. and students from around the world. And they would learn everything from plowing with a water buffalo to molecular breeding. It was a really wonderful experience.
My entire career, I've had a lot of ties with CEMET, so the Wheat and Maize Research Institute, and I've always been very aware of Erie, trying to figure out how to do fertility and rice in Oklahoma just so I can get that tie, which, But so in the functionality of doing rice in the Great Plains, you know, tell us about how do you do rice work in Manhattan and in Colorado Springs? How do you do rice work?
All of my work is in greenhouses and growth chambers. And I always say I have the biggest rice crops in Kansas or in Colorado, and it's two greenhouse loads. But I also, all of the field work was in the Philippines, and that's where the collaboration was essential. And I still have wonderful collaborators, not only in the Philippines, but also in SEOD in Colombia, that where all the field stuff, because they can do field studies on a scale that we could never imagine in the U.S. And they're wonderful collaborators as well. So I would bring the bacterial genetics, the plant molecular biology as my skill set. And then I would work with the plant pathologists there and also the breeders and other folks. So it's been, it's really fun to have these broad collaborations.
So has the work been more focused on paddy rice, or is it also applicable to upland? And you know, where is that?
So historically, it was all in paddy rice. But it's interesting that you bring up the newer dry seeding methods is where we're interested right now. And the project that I just am working on with SEOT in Colombia is to look at rice varieties that are adapted to climate change. And one of the adaptations is to use less water and therefore the dry seeding and also temperature resistance, as well as temperature and disease tolerance under these different conditions, the high temperature conditions that we see with climate change.
That's absolutely fascinating. So I guess before we transition to the wheat stuff, what's been some of the whether it's advancements or the big aha moments, what are some of the things that you've been able to achieve working in the rice blight?
Mm-hmm. So one of the most interesting things that I think my passion project is the fact that rice is more susceptible to disease under high temperatures. But the thing that's not so surprising, we figured that was going to happen. But what was surprising to me is that many of the disease resistance genes that our breeders took years to integrate into rice break down at high temperature. They're not effective, but there are a few that are. And I want to know why are those few standing up in the field and still resistant under high temperatures, whereas all the other resistance genes have just, they're totally ineffective.
When you say high temperatures, and what is that range? Because is it just high temperatures? Is it also high temperature and humidity? Is it a singularity?
That's an excellent question. It is very likely high temperature and humidity. But for me to study high temperature and humidity would mean I needed to have about 6 growth chambers. And I don't. So I focus on high temperature, but I keep it at high humidity as best I can. So I try to eliminate the humidity differences as a factor. But you're absolutely right. It's a system. It's the whole environment taken as a whole.
In your growth chambers, in your greenhouses, are you taking a lot of it to full maturity? Or is it just how far in the growth process of the rice cycle are you getting?
So fortunately, with bacterial blight, we can do assays at the young stage, like 21-day old plants. But for some of our studies, we do take them to all the way to seed set. For example, we just recently described a new disease in collaboration with work with folks at Stuttgart in Arkansas at the Rice Research Institute there. A new disease on rice that is, it's been found elsewhere in the world, but it had never been described in the U.S. It's a Pantoi ananatus. It's another bacterial pathogen. And we think that there's a climate interaction here. We think that's why it hasn't been seen, because this organism is normally an endophyte. And our hypothesis is it's sort of an endophyte gone wild under high temperature conditions, but that's a hypothesis at this point.
Well, so I'm going to transition us into the discussion on the Russian wheat aphid. And before we get too much into it, I want to say, because you mentioned a phrase, a terminology that I'd like you to kind of break down for the audience, is You said it's the microbiome associated with Russian wheat aphid. Can you kind of give us the 50-cent version of what is microbiome?
Sure. So the microbiome are the microbes that are associated, the community of microbes that are associated with either an insect or a plant or a human being. And, you know, you see a lot of research nowadays that our microbiome is almost another part of our genome because it influences our health and our function. And it's true in insects, it's true in plants. The microbiomes associated with them are very important to their health and survival or to how they impact each other. And that's where we were really interested. It's a story of where I was serving on a PhD committee in our soil and crops department. And a young man named Leon Van Eck was studying Russian wheat aphid in wheat. And he was interested in the phenotype is sort of a yellowing of the leaves. And he was interested in what was causing that yellowing. And the assumption was that it was toxins or effectors produced by the Russian wheat aphid that were introduced into the plant. So he did a proteome analysis to see if he could find proteins that would induce this phenotype. But when he did the proteome analysis, from the saliva of the aphid, less than 1% of the proteins were aphid proteins. The rest were bacterial proteins. And they were bacteria, a community of bacteria. And so I was on his committee, and of course, being a microbiologist, I got kind of excited about that. And so then we followed it through, and over the years, we've shown that if you get clean aphids, aphids that are free from their microbiome, and the way we got this is an interesting story, but if you get aphids that are free from their microbiome, they don't cause the chlorotic phenotype on wheat. And then we did a number of studies, and we isolated the microbes. We characterized the microbiome. We have some candidates for the ones that are important in that community, but we know also that the microbiome it's the microbiome associated with the honeydew. So when the honeydew of the aphid collects on the leaves, the stylet feeds through that. Messy stuff on the leaf and carries the microbes inside the plant. The microbes are not coming through the stylet. They're on the surface of the stylet.
That puncturing.
Yeah.
That you're getting that's fascinating.
Yeah. And once inside the plant, it's very interesting. The plant responds as plants do. And it responds with a salicylic acid defense response or a type of response, which is typical of bacteria inducing salicylic acid. And it turns out that that seems to be antagonistic to jasmonic acid responses. So we see the salicylic acid response go up and the jasmonic acid response go down, or genes involved in those responses. So the microbiome of the aphid, which is essential for aphid virulence or function, is actually controlling the phenotype on the plants.
Well, you know, this is funny. Reading through your notes, and I say, you know, the Russian wheat aphid, I'm thinking aphid, I'm thinking wheat, microbiome. Oh, we're going to talk about virals and the vector of viruses, because that's, you know, we really think about it. And so now we're actually talking about bacterial infection via an aphid that I'm usually worried about a viral vector in many of our things, not just Russian, but is it just the Russian wheat aphid that is doing this, or is similar our green bug and our other aphid populations having similar biomes?
So, you know, it is interesting. So Russian wheat aphid, interestingly, does not vector viruses. It's unusual in that respect. There are certainly other insects that vector bacteria. So Pierce's disease of grape is a xylella that that a glassy wing sharpshooter introduces into the plant via its stylet. Interestingly, that bacteria comes through the inside of the stylet and into the plant. So it multiplies in the insect's foregut, and then it's introduced into the plant. So, you know, it's a plethora of things that could, and in fact, we thought, you know, we were assuming that our bacteria would be introduced through the stylet, the inside of the stylet, and were rather surprised when we did a microscopy of the stylets and couldn't find any bacteria inside.
I just going through that honeydew.
Yeah, interesting.
That makes sense. And so you mentioned it, so I've got to bring it up. So how did you get it free from the microbiome? What processes did it require to get to that point?
So initially, we did what some other people did. We treated with antibiotics. But remember that aphids have an endosymbiont that is essential to the survival of the aphid. It's a bacteria, Buchnera, that they must have or they can't survive. So if you use antibiotics, you kill that endosymbiont, and the aphid is not happy at all. And so the aphid, we tried that. We tried different antibiotics, but we could never get happy aphids. So aphids give live birth, and they're actually born pregnant, essentially. And so what my graduate student did is she sat with a paintbrush type thing. And when the baby was being born, she snatched it or kidnapped it and then put it on a clean plant. So it didn't get in the mess of the honeydew that its mother and its siblings had left behind. So we would establish clean colonies that we could keep clean for quite a while. And they then were our clean aphids versus our dirty aphids.
I'm telling you, the things we get grad students to do for probably
she
not enough pay.
Now.
That's, oh, that would be a process. Oh, that's a lot. So I guess kind of wrapping this up, you're finding this, you know, the processes. If we're looking to the application next stage, what do we then, where can this go as far as we're trying to, is it in the control or just better understanding of what's going on?
Well, hopefully in the Russian wheat aphid story, my hope is that if we understand which microbes or how the microbes are involved, we might be able to manipulate the microbiome by putting a community of microbes on the surface of the leaf, or by breeding for resistance to the microbes, not the aphid, because we have very few sources of resistance that are functional against the aphid itself. But it's possible that since the microbes are essential for aphid virulence or aggressiveness, we might be able to breed for resistance to the microbes, and that would make our wheat more resistant. These are all things we'd like to think about. Yeah.
It's time for our famous three.
Are you ready to maximize your acres? Discover KWS Hybrid Rye, the high-yielding rye with Pollen Plus technology. Designed for superior growth and resilience, KWS Hybrid Rye helps you achieve greater productivity and profitability. Don't miss out on this innovative solution for your fields. Visit KWS.com today to learn more about how KWS Hybrid Rye can transform your farming practices. KWS Hybrid Rye, growing innovation for your future.
It's time to wrap up and get the three questions. So as you look at, and it could be now or any time in your career, as you're going through this and you're establishing problems, you have questions, what have been some good resources you have when it comes to questions?
Oh, you know, the scientific literature is, I think it's hard for students to keep up with it nowadays. And it's hard for us. it boggles my mind. But you know, I can't necessarily keep up with the literature like I used to, but by going to meetings and listening to people talk about their research and being able to ask questions, I think the one-to-one interactions help supplement this deficiency in our ability to keep up with the literature.
Well, and you mentioned that some of this work came from being on committees, and that's one thing I love. And I do it because I'm extension, but being on as many committees and as many, whether it's AgEcon or it doesn't really matter. I feel like that cross-discipline nature of me learning the intricacies of other sciences helps so much.
Yeah, as an extension person, it's essential for you to have those interactions.
As we move outside of work, you know, what do you do for fun? What's your favorite leisurely activity?
Well, my favorite activity is hiking. I have two Australian shepherds, and my husband and I love to hike with them. But I also do a lot of reading. I love to read. So
those Aussies take some energy. So
they have a lot of energy. Yeah.
And finally, where do people go to find more about your work and your lab, Dr. Leach?
So I have a website which they can find, or they can just email me. I love it when people write me questions, and I love to respond to that. So my website would be located in our department, Agricultural Biology at Colorado State University.
Well, folks, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wyzenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Jan Leach, University Distinguished Professor, Colorado State University. So if y'all enjoyed this, make sure you subscribe to the channel so that you get notifications anytime we drop a new podcast. Also, share this video with those you think might enjoy it or need to learn something today. And finally, don't be afraid to leave us a comment, whether it's a suggestion or a guest or a question, just let us know. Dr. Leach, it's been a ton of fun. I've learned so much. Thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun for me too.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.